Hi, everybody. This is Chris Holmes of Popdose.com, and I am joined by D.W. Dunphy. Today, we are launching the newest Popdose podcast series, which we'll have a clever name we'll think of later. But for now, we'll call it Desert Island Discs. The first selection for our series is, but seriously, folks, solo album from Eagles guitarist Joe Walsh, released on May 16th, 1978, peaking on the U.S. Billboard album charts at number 8 and spawning the top 20 single, Life's Been Good. D.W., let's go ahead and get started with you. How did you come to love this album, and how did you come to know it?
Well, I think I came to know it the way that a lot of people came to know it, and it's rather bizarre because you can't imagine how it came through, coming through the way it, you know, way music does now, and that is on AM radio, where more often than not, they would actually play the entire 7-whatever-minute song, beginning to end. Now, usually, most radio AM at that time, they would do the radio edit, and some of them did. But I know firsthand that many times they played the whole thing. It's unheard of. And it's really a bizarre song. You're starting with this honky-tonk barroom blues that rolls into a reggae song, for God's sake, then into sort of a pop song, and then you have, what, about 3 minutes of instrumental music going right back into it, and it's comical. I was sold on it when I heard that, and then when I went to the record store and I saw the album, it looks like no other album that has ever been seen, in my mind, at least not in the past 10 years. So it's one of those things, it's kind of hard not to love this album on one level or another.
Okay, so let's talk about the visuals on this album, because I'm a visual guy. You and I both grew up during the waning days of vinyl as the medium of choice for music listeners. So we had the front cover with Joe. Looks like he's submerged in a pool with... There's a table, it's a picnic table with food floating in the water. I don't know what the hell is going on here. I'm going to assume there was some kind of massive quantity of drugs involved. I think that's a pretty safe assumption, unless you know any better.
No, I don't really know anything other than, yeah, he was an eagle. Okay, that probably does fit into a lot of where his head was at that time.
Yeah, so Joe, not exactly known for his sober, austere album covers, and on the back of the original vinyl, or maybe it's in the gatefold, there's a more wide-angle shot of Joe, kind of giving this what the fuck look and this hands expression, and it's got the table with the little umbrella. It looks like a sidewalk cafe table. It's definitely not something you would have seen on any of the Eagles albums at the period. They definitely had wrenched all the fun out of that band by that time.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that really comes through with Joe Walsh himself, because after that, there was There Goes the Neighborhood, and that's him with that utter bemusement look on his face sitting in a tent, looking at a pile of rubble. A lot of that got squeezed out of his own thing later on. You Bought It, You Name It was okay. The Confessor looked like it was one step short of a Dio album. But at this period of time, he was really right on it with the idea of comedy without being, you know, jokey, but having that right. Satirical edge was fine in a song. You didn't have to be Don Henley.
Yeah, and you know, and I think in an age when popular music really was starting to become a little ponderous and a little pretentious, you want to talk about the days when progressive rock in particular was becoming really unsufferable, or insufferable in English, for even for fans of the genre. You know, certainly you had a lot of people who were into disco, but that whole scene, although, you know, it had the trappings of fun, it was also pretty decadent and shallow, I think. And, you know, here you had Joe Walsh, really one of the clown princes, if you will, of rock at the time. I'm really curious. I understand from a musical standpoint why the Eagles wanted him. I really can't imagine how that blend of personalities went.
I would say, just from all the stuff that I've read about him, he's really kind of a go-along to get-along kind of guy. He's very amiable, and I think they just didn't want somebody who was going to push too hard.
Because at that point, it really was Henley's and Fry's band, right?
Yeah, and you could get screwed over at a moment's notice. I mean, we've heard many, many stories on the site. We've reported many, many stories.
Yeah.
So I think they were kind of looking for somebody who was going to jump in and do well, but wasn't going to rock the boat and was just going to be happy to be there. And God bless him, I think Joe Walsh fit the bill.
Yeah. So let's talk about some of the background of the album itself. Released in May of 78, I don't know what the recording dates were. I'm going to assume sometime maybe late winter, early spring of 78, which would mean it's coming in between legs of the Hotel California tour, probably also overlapped with the recording of the Long Run album, which, you know, there's a whole other episode we could do on the recording of that album.
Yeah.
So in the midst of all that, Joe breaks away to record another album, manages to have some of the Eagles come along to provide backing vocals, and I know that Don Felder provided guitar on a couple of the tracks, but by and large, this is the Joe Walsh show, as his previous albums had been, with Bill Simzik, and I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, in as the co-producer once again, who obviously has that deep association both with Joe and then later on with the Eagles.
What I like about... I think his name is pronounced Zemchek.
Zemzek.
Either way, I don't really know. I wish they had some phonetic spelling somewhere. They've got everything on the internet except for the phonetic spelling of Joe's name. Anyway. Bill's name, sorry.
I actually looked it up in Wikipedia, but they have this really bizarre phonetic pronunciation thing that they've adopted. I'll be damned if I can make heads or tails of it.
But I will say this about his production. It is very complex if you are listening to it for complexity. If you're just listening to it straight out, there's nothing that's going to beat you over the head. But it was perfect for the Eagles, and it was perfect for Joe Walsh at this time. If you're listening to a lot of the album, especially the whole Boat Weirdos part of this album, there's a lot going on, but only if you're going to sit there and parse it.
Right.
Which is something I appreciate, because there are always these producers that have specific sounds that beat you over the head. Much as I love Roy Thomas Baker's production sound on The Cars and Journey and all that, you can tell that it's Roy Thomas Baker. There's no question about it. But with Bill Simcik... or however.
We'll just call him Bill.
Bill, let's just stick with Bill. With Bill, the music comes first, and then you can figure out the layering that he's doing to fatten things up.
Yeah, and to be certain, there are a lot of intricacies involved here, but yeah, it's definitely a very unobtrusive production approach, and I really think it serves the music well because, well, Joe's a pretty unfussy guy. He has pretty unfussy music, despite the technicality of it, and of course his rather superb playing. If you really want to dive deep into it, there is plenty to enjoy there. Atmospheric keyboards where you might not expect them. Some really excellent. The mixing is fantastic. You know, I was listening to this album again today, and this is going to sound like a strange connection, but another album that came out that year that I associate this with is actually the Rick Wright solo album, Wet Dream. It has, in my mind, even though his album is a lot more atmospheric and you kind of just float along with it, just like his work in Pink Floyd, it has that same really immersive, almost gauzy feel to it, but not in a bad way, not where it's muffled. It's just this incredibly warm, inviting sound that is... It's
right.
when you first start listening to it, it just feels right, and it's the kind of sound that countless people try to recreate now by plugging in their old Orange amps and, you know, going with tape, and I don't know why, but it just, you can't recapture that sound anymore.
I think a lot of it is because most of, it's a sweeping generalization, but I think a lot of the bands now that want to capture that sound are still hitting the multi-tracking too hard. We're talking about a time where I think a lot of these bands started, or these performances started in a one take, and then they would strip away things and they could add and layer and this and that. But there was some sort of group dynamic at the recording of it. And I don't think you can match that anymore unless you seriously, you know, hold up in a shed and forced upon yourself just what is great but antiquated by today's standards.
Right. Okay, so let's get into the music, shall we? So we have the opening cut here, penned by Joe, over and over. Fantastic way to start the album for me. The guitar work here is beautifully layered, and the thing that I love about this song and a lot of the rest of this album is that even as the Eagles, and you know we're going to have to keep making this comparison because you really can't escape it, even as the Eagles were moving into a more straight, hard rock, moving away from the kind of country-tinged, laid-back sound, the Southern California sound, if you will, I really think that on this album and this song, Joe manages to kind of out-eagle the Eagles, if you will. It's got this fantastic blend of the rock edge to it, and yet it feels completely laid-back and unfussy.
That, and it's also got this slight hint of the reggae sound to it. Sort of in the... I'm thinking more of the verse side of it, because obviously the choruses have a lot more punch to it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're listening to it, it does have that mellow, laid-back, at points, feel of some reggae, which creeps in a little bit throughout the entire album.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is something that I don't think that the Eagles would have stood by for at all. So this is really, I would imagine, this was just like a great opportunity for him to add in everything that he knew he wasn't going to get in there and wasn't even going to fight about it. It's like, I'll keep it for myself. No problem.
Yeah, absolutely. So in true, you know, prime 70s production style, we've got these excellent segues, these fades, not even really a fade, going right into the second track, Secondhand Store. Is it any wonder you end up sitting in a secondhand store on display in a window? Wind up sitting in the bottom of a drawer any way the wind blows. And this is really where he kicks up the kind of Eagles sound, or the Eagles sound filtered through Joe Walsh. And of course, it's probably no coincidence that Don Felder does in fact make an appearance on the track on guitar. Beautiful, laid back, but never too slow, never gets drowsy, like I think can be a trap that you can fall into. But it's really a beautiful song. I love the lyrics to it. You know, again, with Joe, you're never going to get these deep examinations of the human condition, but the opening couplet there, "You lost your color when you painted the town, painting by the numbers." I mean, that's a fantastic lyric.
I would say this is probably the height of some of his best lyrics, and the one that keeps coming back to me is the point where he's saying, you know, sitting on a sandbar down to a handful of treasures, another shot of gold won't get you very far when you've got forever. You know, and yeah, with Joe Walsh, you're sort of at odds, because here's the guy who a few years later is going to choke out the lyric, "Pick up the dog, do hope that it's hard." Okay. But I mean, there are points where his lyrics are just great on this album. I mean, they surpass things that he's done afterward.
Absolutely.
And this is definitely one of the songs where he gets to prove himself as a lyricist, which was nice.
Right. And so we come to track number 3, and this is really, in my mind, where the album starts to peak. Indian Summer. Taken back, I was younger. this is, in my mind, one of the two best songs from the album, and I am not including Life's Been Good on that, and we can hash that out later, but I'm going to go on record here saying that Life's Been Good is probably only the third best song on this record. It's one of those songs, it's so complex. It's got those soaring, Eagle-esque vocal harmonies. It does meander a little bit, but it's just so effortless. I mean, you know that there's probably take after take, and just this the level of sheer talent behind this song between Joe Vitale, between Willie Weeks. I mean, just, you know, a murderer's row of musicians. But man, it sounds like the kind of thing that they probably came up with in one take, the bastards, you know?
Yeah. It definitely is one of those things that causes you some serious envy. But here again is the point with Bill that I think is so wonderful. At the end of that song, there's timpani, there's, you know, there's a fair amount of orchestration going on at the end of that song that you're not expecting, yep. And you're not really hearing. Again, it's not like Yes level bombast where they're going to throw everything at the kitchen sink at you.
Right.
It's just laid right in there, and it's going along, and it sounds beautiful. When you listen back to it later with a more critical eye, you're like, they're really doing a lot of stuff on that.
Yeah, I mean, you really can enjoy it on two levels. It's got that kind of audiophile treat quality to it, but if you put this on the car stereo, it is the perfect Sunday afternoon driving music.
Yeah. And funny thing is that like I said before, I got the album because of Life's Been Good, and that was really early on. Now, we're talking about the 70s, which is horrible for me to think about. But
yeah.
But later on, when I was of driving age, I bought the cassette. It's one of my first cassettes that I bought instinctively and for the purpose of driving around with. And, you know, it is a summertime song. If you can imagine just sort of that lazy, warm summer, it's a perfect song for that. There's no question.
Absolutely. And so ending what used to be known as Side A, which is something that only us old farts remember, is, in my mind, the pinnacle of the album, and that's At the Station. I can backtrack for a second. You talked about how you were sucked into the album, so to speak. I'm an actual relative latecomer to both Joe Walsh and the Eagles. I really have never been all that invested in the Eagles. Of course, I made the requisite Hotel California BMG CD club purchase back in the 90s.
You got suckered, man.
I sure did. Well, I mean, look, I had already plowed through the entire Led Zeppelin catalog. Where the hell else could I go?
Yeah.
So I actually first came through Joe on his The Smoker You Drink, The Player You Get album, another just fantastic album, and one we easily could have chosen for this first edition. But the Eagles, you know, I gotta admit, I really have never warmed up to them all that much. But Joe, his catalog, I definitely dig, and so I made the effort to explore a little more past that album, moved on to this album, and then got to At the Station, and holy crap, I was floored at just one of the best rock tunes, I think, if not of that year, then of the late 70s period. And, you know, I have no problem stating that.
And it's one of those songs that I have to do a lot of assuming, but it seems like there's a lot of backstory or situation involved with it, because it does mirror, in a way, In the City off of The Long Run.
That's exactly the comparison I was going to make.
But here's the thing. In the City was originally written and recorded for the soundtrack of the movie The Warriors. So that was even before the long run. So if he started with At the Station, then he recorded In the City for The Warriors, and then he was like, ah, screw that, I'm going to give it over to the Eagles, and then it's on the long run. This one song has really morphed into an entirely different thing, if that is in fact the case. But I would say that it was never done as well as it's done on here. But for all the reasons you said, it's a drive-in sort of really charging song, and it's got that energy behind it. I don't know how else to say it. I really don't know how else to say it.
Well, I think the hidden weapons on this song, and I think it's probably due time that we gave them their credit, is the rhythm section.
So
Joe Vitale on the drums, Willie Weeks on the bass. I really think that as fantastic as Joe sings and plays on this song, it is the two of them that make this thing go. I could sit and listen to, you know how on YouTube you can find isolated bass tracks from, say, John Entwistle or Geddy Lee. I would love to hear an isolated bass part from Willie Weeks on this song, because it is one of the most tastefully complex rock performances I've heard on an album.
And I will add that I think that this album really does not get the kind of adoration it probably deserves, only because of the weight of Joe Walsh's comical eccentricities, let's put it that way. There is a lot of really great playing on here, and I don't see, maybe I'm wrong, maybe it is out there, but I just don't imagine Classic Albums putting out a documentary on it, which is kind of sad, because I'd really like to know what that dynamic in the studio was all about.
Yeah, it's funny. I mention occasionally that I listen to the album. I'll post on Twitter, and I get a bunch of responses back saying, oh man, I haven't listened to that album in 15 years. I haven't listened to that album since high school. And again, I'm a latecomer to that album, and I said, I haven't stopped listening to it. How could you not make a point of listening to this album at least once a year?
Right.
So, yeah, I think it gets lost down the memory hole. Probably, again, it's because of the way it fits into the chronology between Hotel California and The Long Run. I just think that people loved it, and they probably would love it if they went back and explored it, but somehow I think it's disappeared from the larger consciousness.
Yeah, I would agree with that, yeah.
So we have the crescendo of this song where it almost, and this is where we can credit Bill, what's his name? It almost sounds like it's going to fall apart and just completely go off the rails, because you really, that's the one point in this album, I think, where the production really starts to come to the forefront. It has that kind of escalation of tension to you. And then it just kind of fades away, and then they go into a little coda piece, which is basically just the main opening riff from Over and Over. So it's really a nice kind of antidote to the heaviness of this track.
Actually, I think it's what you call it again? Secondhand Store again.
Oh, is it second? Okay.
I believe that's what that little bit of coda. And I've heard a lot of people referring to sort of the sequencing of this. They're using terms like Abbey Road, and I don't know, maybe that's a bit too much, but there does seem to be a sense they wanted to keep things interconnected.
The phrase I did read in several reviews was song cycle.
Yeah.
And as much as you can have a song cycle with really songs that are more observational in nature than, say, character sketches, I think I would agree with that. It's one of those albums that really needs to be listened to as an album in the exact order that it was sequenced in. It is definitely not just a series of good single entities.
Right. It's not a singles album.
Right.
And that probably is the reason why that they only had one single official single, as far as I know, off of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because you really can't pick it apart without it falling down just a little bit.
And I think that starts to become especially evident on the second side, which we're going to get into now. Come from behind today. side B with Tomorrow. And our buddies Don, Glenn, and Timothy pop in to provide some backing vocals. And whatever you want to say about them as people, as musicians, you really could do a lot worse than to have the Eagles as your backing vocalists on a song.
It's one of those difficult things that you sort of accept that when they vocalize together, they are great. You can't deny it. And it's one of those things that I always have difficulty with as a consumer of pop culture, of music and movies, is that you have to try to divorce yourself from the people who created it, from the creation. Because at a certain point, you don't want one lapsing into the other, because you don't like the things you hear about their personalities, but you love what they do.
You know, I have to say that that's never really been a problem with me for them, only because I never became so invested in the band or knowing about the people. I've heard plenty of references to what kind of people they are, and I got a few more glimpses of that in the recent interview we ran on Pop Dose with Don Felder. But like with Kiss, for example, you know, I know every piece of Dirty Laundry that is to know about Gene Simmons and Paul Stanley. And I am able to overcome it to remain a fan of the band. With the Eagles, yeah, I guess I've heard that in general those guys are douchebags, and I guess it's true, but I really don't know, and it really never comes into play for me. The reason I never engage with them is because I'm just simply not that big a fan of their music, other than the hits.
This is like the first time I've ever imagined Kiss and the Eagles in the same room. What a mess.
Yeah, I know. It always comes back to Kiss for me. I'm ashamed to admit.
The Golden Gods and the Fire Breather.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So Tomorrow.
I think this is where the album starts to get a little slight from the songwriting standpoint and gets by a little more on atmospherics and feel than on the music itself. It probably could have stood to have one more song with a little more meat in it. I don't know what that would have meant in terms of the constraints of vinyl's playing time of the era. One of the reasons people think a little less of this album or don't think of it at all is it does run out of energy a little bit, but that's where I find it becomes more of an album listening experience than a song listening experience. Make our way from Tomorrow into, I'm going to combine Inner Tube and Theme from Boat Weirdos, because really they're the same. It's yeah. Part of the same song. I'm not sure why the artificial separation, other than maybe they thought somebody would have been freaked out only seeing, you know, three songs on the backside, thinking, whoa, hey buddy, you know, don't start getting into ELP territory here.
I've got a feeling that, you know, I was reading up on this a little bit just to make sure that my facts match with the actual facts. One or the other is co-written with Jay Ferguson,
right?
Who was with JoJo Gunn, was with Spirit, and around this time, I guess it was around this time, he would have released Thunder Island, which was another Asylum Records pretty big hit.
Yep.
So I've got a suspicion that the break is just because there's a part he contributed to and a part he did not contribute to. And this was just sort of an area of demarcation.
Yeah, that actually makes sense to me. Willie Weeks also getting a co-write on Theme from Boat Weirdos. I don't know that there's an accurate way for me or a colorful way for me to actually describe those two songs, Inner Tube and Theme from Boat Weirdos. They really have to be heard. I think that if Joe had brought them to the Eagles, maybe he did, they would have smacked the sheet music right out of his hands.
Yeah, I mean, it's they're one. It's an instrumental. They are instrumentals. which is not a strong suit for the Eagles, even though they did the theme from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which the name of it I can't remember right now, or it was co-opted for the theme for Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Right.
They are not known for instrumental work. They're really not. So that takes that out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, it's mood music. It's almost like... it's almost like music that you would see in a movie. It's very background sort of scene setting music. And that's what I've always appreciated about it, because I'm big on movie soundtracks. I like movie soundtracks a lot. The real scores beyond, you know, the song ones.
Right.
And the idea that in the middle of this very boisterous album, you would have just, a scene. It's the background of a scene. I always thought that was really impressive to me, because it's like, okay, now you know what we do in songs. Now we're just going to play for you. Just enjoy our playing for a while. It takes a lot of nerve to do that, especially on an Asylum Records release where you're thinking, yeah, somewhere in a corner office, David Geffen is probably blowing his cork, because it's like, I can't release that as a single.
Yeah, I think that type of music is not without precedent in Joe's catalog, at least. Although, perhaps not quite as mellow as that. I guess the best way that I could phrase it would be incidental music.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, similar to, you know, your soundtrack music. It's definitely the type of music or the type of songs that really you would only hear on an album from the 70s. People just don't really do that kind of thing anymore. It seems like every song has to have an explicit purpose, and it has to grab you.
It has to be a single ready song now. You can't have, and I don't want to use the term filler, because it's not filler, but you cannot have something that exists for the purpose of expanding what the album is. Everything has to be ready to go for a single.
Yeah, I definitely think it elevates above the level of filler. That being said, I don't think I would ever put my vinyl of this album on because I want to hear a theme from Boat Weirdos.
Yeah, well, you leave it on side one. Yeah.
I would
nothing I, wrong with that. Nothing
I would
wrong
bet
with that.
I would bet money that if we were go to use record store and thumb through the copies of But Seriously Folks and examine the grooves under a microscope, we would probably find side one being a lot more worn than side two, with the exception of Life's Been Good.
I would almost guarantee it. I mean, you and I are both within driving distance from Princeton Record Exchange. I would imagine that is exactly what you would find. Unquestionably.
So, yeah.
My fans, they can't wait. They write me letters, tell me I'm great. So I got me an office, gold records on the wall. Just leave a message, maybe I'll call.
Speaking of Life's Been Good, let's get down to it. It's obviously the big hit from the album, the only hit from the album. It did make it into the Eagles set lists, I do believe, for the... I don't know if it made it into the end of the Hotel California set, but it definitely made it into the Long Run set. In fact, a couple Joe Walsh songs made it into the Eagles set, which an uncommonly generous move on the part of Messrs. Henley and Fry.
That's true, except I would sort of say I don't really recall any of Glenn Frey's solo stuff getting into the latter Eagles repertoire either, but I do recall that Don Henley made sure that New York Minute got in there a lot.
Yeah.
Just, you know, so it's really a feather in Joe's cap that they would grant that this song gets in there, but how could it not? This was a huge hit. It fits into sort of the mindset or the zeitgeist that comes from the Eagles. And Joe plays the hell out of it. Whenever he does it, he invests himself in this thing.
Absolutely. I'm looking, just so you know, I'm looking right now at the set list for the Hotel California tour, and I see Rocky Mountain Way, and I see Funk 49 back from James Gang.
So, all right.
Not bad. And there might have been one other there, but yeah, pretty good. Look, I can definitely see, even though it's not my favorite song on the album, I can easily see why this song attracted you, and I can see why this song was the big hit from the album. It's definitely, putting aside the rather weird bridge part, which is kind of Baba O'Reilly-esque, that just kind of bouncing synthesizer, you know, it's like, put this on, Bill, I gotta go take a piss, I'll be back, and we'll start up again. You know, that's kind of the sense I get from a little bit.
Well, I want to say one thing right off the bat. I tried singing this at a karaoke night. Don't do that. You don't do that, because you're thinking this has got some great lines. This has some funny lines. You're going to kill if you do this at karaoke. Mm. No, you're not. You're going to stand there for 6 minutes doing nothing, looking stupid. Oh, and there I was, looking stupid.
Everybody's checking their watch. The bartender's looking at you all pissed off. Yeah, that's probably good advice.
You know, and the guy who's waiting to get up there to do God Bless the USA, he's not having any of you standing around waiting for the, you know, for it to go round the horn.
Yeah, just do Witchy Woman and be done with it.
There you go. That works. Or Desperado, because that's big with the people who watch Seinfeld. They love their Desperado.
Actually, I want to pay money to see you up there on the stage doing karaoke, doing this song, just so we can get to that last 30 seconds of Here Comes a Flock of Wawas.
Oh, yes, indeed. I love that. I love that. Now, and I mean that sincerely, how much of the opposite of egomania must you have in order to end your big deal album with a sound of experiment of you and the people in your studio at that time quacking?
Yeah, yeah. That's the perfect example of, you've got this really fantastic commercial, but in a good way, hard rock song, and then the last 30 seconds, just tripping balls.
Yep.
You know, you hear it on albums a lot since then, and maybe even before then. I'd be curious to trace the history of these last little 30-second throwaway recorded bits, going back to, I don't know if Her Majesty counts, because it is almost a fully formed song, but there has to be a history that somebody's done of these bits. I'd love to know a little more about that.
It's, you know, the thing that keeps coming up for me is probably at the end of Do You Love Me from Here We Go with Kiss, back in the room, at the end of Destroyer, and then they throw in audience noise for no reason at the very end.
It's the audience noise, and it's actually a piece of the stage banter of Paul Stanley from the Alive album.
Okay.
And it's basically, and I'm pretty sure some of it is looped backwards, which makes sense given that you've got I'm blanking on his name, the producer there.
Bob Ezrin,
yes. You know, probably got a mirror full of coke, and he's like, hey, what the fuck, you know, I'll just loop this backwards. But yeah, that's...
So Alice Cooper would go for it. What are you, pussies? Come on now, man up.
Yeah, yeah, probably the one and only time you would ever put Kiss and weird experimentation in the same sentence. Back to Joe Walsh. I don't want to, you know, I can see the wince on Jeff Giles' face as we keep coming back to Kiss on his Poor Popdos podcast.
Why are they talking about Kiss all the time? Don't we make fun of them? What are we doing?
Yeah, I think I'm going to go and find a way to get into the back end and replace all their Popdos podcasts with just Kiss albums. And just wait for the...
And credit them all to Dave Lifton. Or his mom, you know, why not?
Just wait for the sound of a head exploding somewhere in the northeastern United States.
Oh, Lord. Oh, and poor Matt Wardlaw is going to get blamed somehow. I just know it.
Yeah, it's only right. Oh, God. Okay, so that's the end of the album. any parting thoughts as we approach the getting close to the 45-minute mark here and probably far exceeding the limits of our audience's patience?
Yeah. Kiss. What about no? I think that really what we need to see is that we're talking about a time that doesn't exist anymore, which is unfortunate. I liked the most recent Joe Walsh album, which was produced by Jeff Lynne, and it sounds like a Jeff Lynne album, as all his albums sound.
Mm-hmm.
But it lacks that sort of freewheeling personality. What's the cover? The cover is Joe Walsh, a tasteful black and white picture, standing there with his guitar, which is what all the records, CDs, music is. You have the act standing there looking at you. And that sort of energy of, we're going to take this picture in a pool, damn it. You know, that's just not there anymore.
I suspect, and I don't know, I'm probably projecting completely here. I think all you need to know about that in terms of his approach to the album cover is when the Eagles reconvened, I heard a lot of rumbling that Joe Walsh was included in that under the conditions that basically clean up your act. So he comes out there wearing a suit, wearing his close cropped, hair, looking all sharp, looking all neat, not ruffling any feathers. And I suspect, I'm going to imagine at this point he's cleaned up. I don't really know much about Joe Walsh's personal life, but I think that spark of weirdness that may have been part of his youth, may have been the chemicals, I don't know. I think is probably gone, but hey, if that's going to extend his life, then God bless him.
Yeah, I would never begrudge somebody, providing themselves a little life longevity. I think it's unfortunate, though, that it's endemic of the entire music industry, that it is so programmed.
Mm-hmm.
This is how you've got to do it now. And if you don't do it, you're going to be seen as a weirdo outlier, and we're not going to promote you. We're not going to give you a chance, and neither will the audience. And you're not going to get albums like this anymore if you don't allow people to break out of it a little bit. So there's a bit of sadness because of that.
I'm hard-pressed to think of somebody now with the stature and the talent of a Joe Walsh coming out with an album like this. And I'm not even talking about the 70s kind of sounds. I'm talking about all the different styles that get thrown into it, all the different moods, all the different atmospheres, the incidental music. I can't think of somebody that, a relatively current artist that you would hear this from.
I would suspect that you would see this more, believe it or not, on the countryside. But even at that, there are so many strictures about what a modern country album is that even that might not be suitable for that audience. But in regular pop rock, no, you're not going to see it. I just don't believe that.
Yeah, and I really think that we're the lesser for it, not to, get all maudlin and nostalgic. I would not hold this album up as one of the 20 best albums of the 70s. But it's the type of album that is dearly missed nowadays.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, that's about all I can think of to pontificate on for this album. Probably.
Except maybe you should go out and, we'll probably provide some links. Go out and check out the album yourself. I think that, speaking for you, as I probably shouldn't since you're here, but it's something I think the Popdos audience, if you haven't checked it out, please just do it. I think you'll appreciate it.
I'm pretty certain it's on Spotify, and if so, then we'll have a playlist available at the bottom. Every song is on YouTube, although, again, listening to it piecemeal like that kind of goes against the way it was intended to be listened to. Get a record player and spend a dollar and get a used copy.
Yeah, please, it's cheap now. You can do it. Just go ahead.
There's no complaining about how expensive music is when you can get a stack of records like this for under $10.
Yep.
All right, now, everybody get off our lawn, okay?
Or else we're going to send Gene Simmons after you. Oop, there I did it again, damn it.
Well, I can't think of a better way to go out than that. So, DW, I thank you for taking time to join me on this exploration of one of the fine albums from the 1970s, and I look forward to yakking with you again on another album, and I'd like to thank everybody for tuning in. And if anybody has any suggestions for albums they'd like to hear, we are definitely all ears, so leave a comment.
But you better make it good, because we are not Jack Furyk, nor are we Rob Smith. I'm sorry.
The first person that puts Frampton Comes Alive gets their fucking access revoked. I'm just telling you right now.
I will beat you over the head with my talk box.
Oh, my. Okay. All right, DW. Thanks a lot. And
thanks for having me on.
We'll wrap again soon.
Uh-oh. Here comes a flock of wham-whams. Wah 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 w